Accession number 18837, Reel 3.
John Stokes, Reel 3.
So I settled down in Colombo as the officer's servant to Captain Spencer Smith, but accommodation was a bit scarce at command headquarters, so he teamed up with another officer, Major King of the Royal Army Service Corps, and they rented a flat, and I was installed as a sort of a housekeeper. I didn't know much about it, so I had to bluff my way through a bit. I didn't know anything about the currency or the food. But we employed a native servant, and we muddled through. I didn't have any military duties, but life got a bit boring, but I was able to go swimming at Mount Lavinia. That's a seaside place near Colombo. When fellows came down from the battalion, they came down on leave, I met up with them, and I met up with that my friend Alan again. This was started, I suppose, in March 1942, but by the end of the year I was getting a little bit bored, and I talked to Captain Spencer Smith, and I said, and the battalion I knew from my friend Alan that were chasing after me, really, one of the missing ranks, and actually before I'd left the battalion, I had applied for a posting to brigade headquarters as a cipher operator, and so I sort of spoke to Captain Spencer Smith, and he resurrected the application, and I think it was the end of the year, in December, I was posted back to the brigade headquarters. So I wasn't far from my old regiment, and I was still a part of the regiment. They were on secondment to the brigade headquarters. So I then joined the signal section at brigade headquarters, and I was trained to be a cipher operator. Now, a cipher operator, roughly, is the fact that communications by radio can be intercepted by the enemy. So if you've got anything to say, you have to sort of put it into other than plain English. And so we had a process of turning the words into either figures or other words. I won't sort of go into details now, but basically, yeah. So basically it was turning this plain language into a cipher language, and then that would go over on the wireless sets to the units, and then they in turn would turn it back on the ciphered text into plain text. So I learned to do that. And then the next thing we knew is that we were on the move again, and we were going up to India on what is known as internal security. Now, India has always had to have a very large garrison of British troops to keep order, because there was a fellow by the name of Gandhi who wanted independence for India, they were causing problems. So we always had to have quite a strong force of British troops around just to make sure he didn't get. So we were up in the central provinces of India on this internal security, and then the word came through that our role was going to change again, and we were going to become what is known as long-range penetration troops. Now, I think I should explain a little bit what this is all about. Now, the Japanese had got a reputation as being invincible, mainly because they could live a simple life, their diet was simple, they were very tough, and they could live off the land. And the job of the British military was to make sure that airfellows could do likewise. So there was a chap by the name of Major Wingate, and in 1943 he led a column behind the Japanese lines, and they'd been quite a they were fed by air supply drops and so on, and he proved that it could be done. So he sold the idea to Churchill and the American president, and the idea was to insert quite a large force behind the enemy lines in central Burma or north Burma. And they chose our division, which was the 70th Infantry Division as we were then, which composed of three brigades, so you multiply all the way along. So it was the 70th British Division together with some other troops, and they were going to put quite a large force behind the enemy lines in Burma. And we were the 16th Brigade being part of the division. We were going to be trained for this long-range penetration force. The training was very rigorous, and we moved up to Gwalior State, not far from the Taj Mahal. It's quite a well-known place. And there we did jungle training. Now, while I was there doing this jungle training, I had what is commonly known as a Dear John letter from my mother, to say that local gossip had told her that my wife had had a child, and so my mother proceeded to find out something about it, and it turned out that she had got in with a group of officers, and one of the officers, in fact, was the father of her child, and we were sort of up in the jungle training at this time, and it was a terrible blow to me because my correspondence, though sketchy, always was sketchy. Basically, I had no idea. I had no idea at all that my wife had any idea of being unfaithful. As a matter of fact, I can't remember quite when, but in a letter to me, she had written out the song Yours. And I don't know if you know the song Yours, but it goes on, Yours to the end of life, dead, and so on. And she'd actually written, she said, this is the song that's the latest time, and this is what you mean to me, and so on. Now, I'd had the letter some months before, but then out of the blue came this news, and it was a terrible shock. And I went to see my officer, and they had welfare people, and they said, well, if you can come to some agreement with your wife to resume normal married life, you can go home and leave. But she must agree. So this is what I did. I wrote home and said, well, okay, far as I was concerned, so I would accept the child, we'd sort of bring it up as her own, and so on. But she wrote back and said no, she was going to stay with this officer. So when I went to see my company commander to see the result of the application, he sort of was quite dismissive about the whole thing. And he said, well, you won't go on leave. He said, your wife doesn't want you. Don't waste any more time on her. He said, we're going into action. You're getting promotion, and forget it. And that was, to me, the worst aspect of the whole of the war, because it was a lack of contact which was the cause. Now, if Japs hadn't come into the war, maybe I would have been going home anyway and it wouldn't have happened, because the war in the Middle East was under control. But there we were. I'd already been abroad nearly 3 years, and I didn't know how much longer we were going to be stuck out in the Far East, as it was then. The Japanese were very efficient army, very brutal, uncivilized, and the prospect for us was dire. So that was the condition in which I was training for this other job. Now, what really happened was that the battalions of about 400 men were divided into two columns of troops. And these columns, now 16th Brigade had the job of marching in behind the enemy lines, and they were going to start north of right up in the Leda Road, north of, and they were going to penetrate behind the enemy lines, and it was, and then once they got into the jungle, they were going to make clearings, landing strips for gliders to land with the rest of the force, and this is what my battalion was going to do. Things, the organisation was such that the columns had brigade headquarters, column, but you had a main headquarters in the rear, but the rear was the British front line. But to it being the columns, because it was so physically demanding, you had to be A1 plus health wise. So we were all graded, but I wasn't A1 plus. So fortunately for me, I was allocated to the rear headquarters. I was in the process of reorganization. I had to lose my identity as an infantryman and become a member of the Royal Corps of Signals. And I was then promoted to sergeant in charge of the section. I'd already been promoted as a lance corporal in a small section, but it was a bigger set up altogether. And so this was the promotion that the officer was talking about. And so what happened really was that I think it was January 1944. My brigade and the Queen's, they went, started their march, which was about a 300-mile march behind the enemy lines, in terrible circumstances. And I was in, going to a place called Salette, which was in fact the base, the air base as well. And I was in charge of the section there. And our job, my particular section's job, was to receive the messages radioed out from the columns for what they were requiring for supplies and ammunition and whatever. So it was a very important job. We had to be very, very accurate. And the reception was diabolical. It was quite responsible, but in the emotional state I was in, I was able to focus on something entirely different, and it proved out that I was much more use using my brain than I was as an infantry soldier, much more useful to the war effort. So therefore we settled down into this place called Salette, and I was getting on quite well, but unfortunately we met with the monsoon at the time, so we conditions weren't all that good. We were just we had it, we were under canvas at the time, but the sort of, we were getting torrential rain and very humid heat, and we were working a 24-hour shift, which meant to say that if you worked at night, you worked in this tent with Hurricane Lance. And of course, Hurricane Lance attracted mosquitoes, and the heat from an Hurricane Lance made you sweat. And we had sort of what we call jungle green. It was a sort of a denim type of thing. It was all right while it was dry, but we always had to have our sleeves rolled down and slacks because of mosquitoes. But if you perspired and it got wet, the mosquitoes would penetrate. So we were busy leaning over him, ciphering, and of course we were sweating and up and down the spine. And so that's when I got in the habit of smoking a pipe, and I used to chain smoke with a pipe. And of course, you never light a hot pipe, so I had two pipes of tobacco, one hot and one cold. And that kept the mosquitoes at bay. So I really sort of mentally concentrated on my job. We weren't getting mail anyway because it was very sketchy. But it was serving a purpose. And I suppose the officer was right, really. But it was seemed hard at the time. We started in January 44, and our columns came out of action in May. But I had to take over another brigade section whose troops were still staying in. It's a staging sort of process. So I actually stayed up the jungle until August. When we came out of the jungle, I had a wonderful 4 weeks holiday down in the south of India, up in the Nilgiri Hills on a tea plantation, and it was a really sort of a relaxing time, and we built up our strengths, and we actually had sheets to sleep in, I think, and so it was really, really sort of civilized. This was a lovely spot. It was, of course, a lot of English tea planters in this place, and they'd organized numerous clubs where we could get English teas and buttered crumpets and served by English ladies in lovely rooms with, I believe or not, coal fires. It was a real rest and change, and they called it recuperation leave. Then I rejoined the unit, and virtually we didn't do anything more in the way of the war. We just stooged around, because by that time they were talking about anybody with 5 years overseas service was going to be repatriated. And they had a system whereby they called Python, and for every soldier that was sent home, one would come out from Europe to replace it. See, so there was going to be a gradual turnover of staff. The actual fighting troops of our brigade and division were completely exhausted, and my battalion never went into action again. They were completely clapped out. The formation was still in being, but they were looking forward at that stage to the next stage of the war, where they were going to reform up for eventually reconquering the whole of Burma and going on to Singapore and so on. So that was going to be the future of our formation anyway. But because we'd done well over 4 years, we were all of us virtually, my contemporaries, were due to come home. And so really we stooged around until December, when we were taking, put into a camp called Dulally, down near Bombay, and waiting for the boat. Now there's an expression in the army, if you Dulally, you're a bit nutty. Well, that's the main reason, and that comes from the name of this camp, because going back into history, British troops got what we called suntap, which caused them to be a bit nutty, and they went to this camp. So that's where the word Dulally comes from. And so in December 1944, we got on the troop ship to come home. Now, it was a very strange feeling for me. I didn't really want to go home, because I knew that my wife Mabel wasn't waiting for me. I was a bit apprehensive about civilian life anyway. And they were offering us commissions in the Indian Army, those senior ranks. But my parents were elderly. My mother had been very good to me. She'd written to me every week when I was abroad. She used to send the local paper out to me. She used to send the magazine from the church and so on. So I thought, oh, it's not fair, really. I ought to go home. But it was very heartbreaking, because the fellows were talking about seeing their wives and seeing their sweethearts and so on. So, but anyway, we travelled home and we turned up, and I think we spent Christmas Day at Port Said, and I think New Year's Day at Gibraltar, and we went back through the Mediterranean, landed up in Liverpool Bay, just in Jan. And then I think we lay out there for a couple of days, and eventually we got on trains, and the snow was on the ground, and it was terrible. And we went up to a camp up in Yorkshire in order to, what we say in the army, have our ticulars taken. Ticulars taken. In other words, we had to be documented. We had to have ration books, we had to have English money and leave passes. And I think we'd got off the boat in about 2 or 3 in the morning. We'd landed up at this camp at Thirsk in Yorkshire. 5 o'clock, they said, oh, you can go now. You see, this was these English troops, you see. So we said, well, what about transport then? Oh, the transport packs up at 5 o'clock. Oh, yeah. So how did we get to the station? Oh, well, you have to thumb a lift. Now, we bought our big bags of luggage, you know, with souvenirs and all sorts of things. So anyway, we had to hitchhike down to the station, and we had to stand on the platform in order to pick up a Scottish train as it come through. Of course, when the trains come through, they were packed solid, weren't they? So we stood all the way to London. And, of course, when we got down to London, there was, on some of the platforms, there was tea places and whatever, and welcome to the Vine Army. And of course the war in Europe had started, hadn't it? And these fellows were coming home from leave, on leave, and everything was laid up. There was nothing at all laid on from the Far East repats. They didn't know who we were. And strange as it may seem, because we had bush hats, which is an Australian hat. And I think a lot of us thought we were Australians. And I thought. But anyway, we just crept home. Eventually, I got across to Waterloo and got on the train and got into Woking, I think it was about 7 o'clock in the morning. And I think there was a lady on the ticket, and so I said, any chance of a taxi, you see? Taxi? She said, don't you know there's a war on? I said, yeah, I do know there's a war. Anyway, so I got on the bus, and I landed up at my home, I suppose, about 8 or 9 in the morning. But it was very, very strange. Very strange. Because I hadn't lived in a house for nearly 4.5 years. I hadn't lived in a family environment for that sort of time. Two of my sisters had married. One had married somebody that I'd never seen, and there were the nephews and nieces had arrived. And there was my mum and dad were the same as ever, but I had a spinster sister living there who was a little bit straight-laced. And really speaking, I was lost. Absolutely lost. I had meals and whatever, and on the next day I thought, oh, I'll go and walk around the village to see if I'll see any men or mates. I never knew a soul. There'd been so much people evacuated from London, and the fellows were away in the war anyway. And virtually I thought the people looked at me and I said, I wonder who he is. And this was my home village. And it was very difficult to settle down to a routine. I had 4 weeks holiday, you know, sort of leave. But, I eventually settled down, but we were told that we would only be allowed to be in England for 3 months anyway, and then we'd be going over to Europe. So there I was at home. I was now coming up to my 28th birthday, which is the 29th of March. And I thought, well, now what's the future hold? But anyway, I knew that I would have to go over to Europe. The war was still on in Europe. But anyway, when went back to Thurs, the depot, they told me I was going on a course. So I went on a course to learn the cipher, which was then being used in the European theatre, because it was a different cipher and it was a machines. We were using machines rather like the old type telex machines. So instead of using books as we did in the Far East, we had to learn it on these trains. And actually, we went up to Ilkley in Yorkshire. And it was a lovely spot. And there were lots of young ladies around. And we got plenty, some of them, you know. It was a lovely spot, and obviously they didn't realise the war was on, really, had it. One thing we used to enjoy, they had a lovely hotel on the outskirts of Thurs, and they used to have in this hotel a lady would put a record player on and she accompanied it on a grand piano. Now, this was similar to a radio program. I can't remember the name of it now, but it was sort of like really sort of old English tea dancing, you know. And it was so relaxed and really wonderful. Anyway, that finished. I think we were a month up there. And then... we went down into Kent to wait to go over to Europe. And I thought, well, now, by that time, while we were in Kent, we had VE Day, which was Victory in Europe Day. And we were in this big camp, and all the village turned out and was dancing on the village green and all that, and I thought to myself, I don't know. The war isn't over for any of us, really. You know, sort of, we're still around, and they're my friends, fellows I left in Burma, they were still at it. And so it was a bit of an anticlimax. But there didn't seem to me to be any realisation of what the Far East War was all about. It was all Europe, you know, sort of what D-Day and what the fellows, because I suppose it was just happening at the time.